underwritten in part by a grant from Champagne Cycle, offering equipment, information, and experience to help the active cyclist of any age enjoy the fun of cycling. Champagne Cycle, 506 South Country Fair Drive, just south of Springfield Avenue in Champaign.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 season opens with performances by singer Emmylou Harris, family entertainer Dan Zanes, the Barry Shinkoff Foundation's new theatrical piece, Forbidden Christmas, jazz masters Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis, and sitarist Ravi Shankar. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season.
Don't miss Vintage Vinyl this Saturday at Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana. Come sort through the thousands of CDs and albums for sale at Vintage Vinyl. Takes place this Saturday from 8 to 7 at Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana. Good morning. This is Focus 580 on WILL AM 580. This is our morning telephone talk program, and in for David Inch, I'm Tom Rogers. Every month, David brings in Hank Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service, a longtime home inspector in the Champaign-Urbana area, and has a lot of expertise in what home maintenance and home improvement is all about. And we bring him in once every month to answer some of your questions about home maintenance, home improvement, things around the house that you have questions about. And we love to answer your phone calls. Your phone calls are important for this show, and our numbers are 333-9455 inside the Champaign-Urbana calling area and 1-800-222-9455 throughout the rest of the two states where you're hearing us today. Hank, again, good morning, and welcome to the show. I'm jumping ahead of myself. I never host Focus 580.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and hopefully we can get a lot of questions answered about home maintenance. We'll talk first of all. We'll get a call ready in the meantime. But we'll try line one. Okay, we'll try line one. Oh, there we go. We've got him. We got him here. Line one. I think he's still here.
I'm here.
Okay, we've got a bit of a problem on line one. Once again, with your questions on home maintenance, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Hank, some of the things that that come up at this time of year, I mean, I've noticed in the forecast for the rest of the week, we've got a good chance of rain, and I look at that and watch the rain go down my roof and through my gutters, and hope beyond hope that it's just going away and not inside the house.
Well, that is a major problem. One of the biggest problems with houses in this area is that the builder tends to build them too low to the ground. The house is supposed to be on a little bit of a hill. Mm-hmm. The building code says that there should be a minimum slope of 6 inches in the first 10 feet away from the house on all sides. Now, in order to provide disabled access and so on, this means that there's going to have to be some ramping. We likewise want to be sure that the wood portions of the house are 4 to 6 inches above the soil level. In most cases, this is one step up in order to get into the house.
At least that,
because you have to realize that we've got 12 inches of wood below the floor. And if that wood is going to be above ground level, it's usually two steps or a sloped section.
And wood is not going to last a few seasons of rain.
In order to keep it from getting wet, attracting termites, things like this, we need to get that wood above the moisture line on the outside. And sometimes it takes some window wells to keep, so we can bring the dirt up high enough so that the dirt doesn't go against the wood window frames if you have basement, or crawl space vent wells in order to keep it the dirt away from the crawl space vents, because moisture is the biggest enemy of the house. A wet crawl space will cause problems throughout the entire house. As a matter of fact, it may shorten the life of the roof by 25%.
How's that? Is it just the condensation going up?
Well, if you look at the house as a balloon and you evaporate one drop of water in the bottom of the balloon, it goes everywhere. And it will condense any place there's a cold surface. And the cold surface most frequently encountered is the bottom of the roof sheathing, because that's above the insulation. And so we end up, I have, generally speaking, we get about 20 years out of ordinary shingles, not the heavyweights, but the ordinary shingles, we'll get 20 years. I was on one where I almost fell through it, and it was only 3 years old, because enough moisture from the crawl space had gone up through the house, condensed on the bottom of the roof sheathing, and rotted the sheathing.
How does it go up? Is it just does it just sort of seep through the entire house?
And it moved by vapor pressure. Uh-huh. It will go any place that air can go, but not necessarily in the same direction. So you're moving by vapor pressure, not by air movement. And yes, it pretty well uniformly distributes itself through the house. We finally have gotten most people accustomed to the idea, if you have a crawl space house, the entire soil surface must be covered with a sheet of plastic.
And that's to keep the condensation from starting there in the first place.
That's right.
We
keep the moisture from going up. Even a crawl space where the soil is dusty dry, if you spread a sheet of plastic on it within a couple of hours, you'll have moisture droplets on the bottom of the plastic. Mm-hmm. And this must cover the entire crawl space. And we actually want it lapping up the foundation a little bit.
Do you want it secured down, sort of airtight? Or
It doesn't have to be. Generally speaking, we just suggest lapping the joint 6 inches or so and running it up the foundation such that if any moisture soaks through the foundation, it goes under the plastic rather than on top of it. Once you get moisture on top of the plastic, it has no place to go except to evaporate up into the house because it can no longer soak down. So we've got to keep it off the top of the plastic. That also means that we have to keep water from other sources off the top of the plastic, such as the condensate from the air conditioner. If you ventilate the crawl space in the summertime and you have ductwork down there and running air conditioning, you will probably get condensation on the ductwork.
Just because the ductwork is going to be cool.
That's right. You're below the dew point of the outside air, and it's going to drip down on the plastic, and this too can cause a problem. Mm-hmm. A sump pump is not really a solution to a problem. It is a solution to a symptom. The problem is we're getting water in there in the first place,
right.
And we don't want it there. So you don't put in a sump pump to keep it dry. We want to keep it dry before the water ever gets there, which would never need a sump pump.
But it's pretty obvious in, say, a basement where sump pumps are probably a little more common, but in a crawl space, how do you know?
Well, as I say, you look.
You go down and look.
Most people never look in their crawl space, unfortunately. But even basements do not necessarily have to have a sump pump in them. Mm-hmm. If the grading is done, most of the water that ends up in your basement or crawl space is water off your own roof. So that if you have a good gutter system, the downspouts are extended far enough away from the foundation to a point where the water continues to run away, not run back toward the house, we don't usually have problems. Mm-hmm. I have a basement in my house and I don't have a sump pump in it.
It stays dry because of the...
It stays dry.
Right. Let me first of all, before we go ahead, just make sure that line one isn't working correctly. Or do we have somebody on line one? Okay, we'll take that off offline. There we go. And we remind you once again that our numbers are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. And we do have a call, I guess, on line two. Good morning, line two. Hello, line two. There we go. How you doing?
Hi.
And you've got a question for Hank.
Okay, now. I'm not sure it's exactly a maintenance question, but I hope maybe you have some ideas.
Okay.
I'm looking for some tips on painting, painting in a room. And my problem is how do you make a good straight edge between two different colors? It didn't matter so much when rooms were all being painted white and the ceilings were white, but now that... Like my teenage daughter wants one wall yellow and one wall turquoise blue, and when the two walls meet, it's impossible to get a good edge between the colors. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of technique that professionals use. I've tried taping, masking tape, but it always, some of it bleeds, and then to make the edge really sharp, I just don't know how you do that.
Well, there are some good professional masking tapes and applicators that seem to do a pretty good job.
Every time I use tape, and I work with it a lot, and tape it really carefully, and so on, it inevitably bleeds, or when you pull the tape off, it affects the edge.
Well, this is one of the things. You've got to use a professional grade tape and a professional applicator. This will roll it down, and the tape is designed to release within 36 hours, generally speaking, so that you don't pull anything loose with it and this sort of thing. And professional painters do this regularly.
So just using tape correctly should make the difference.
Yes. Now, this sort of crinkly-looking brown tape is not what you use. This is not a professional-grade tape.
Uh-huh. And what does it look like, the professional?
Most of them are relatively clear. They'll be 2 or 3 inches wide. They'll be thin. They stick down quite well. And if you leave them more than 36 hours, you really play heck getting them off.
Okay. So where do you buy those kind of quality?
You can get them at the stores like Menards, Lowe's, this sort of thing.
All right, and the applicator is
you just roll it on it, and very often these things come in what looks like a 4-inch wide roll, but the plastic attached to it unfolds so it's about 20 inches wide, so you don't slop it all over the place.
And
they seem to work quite well.
And is there a technique maybe to use like a razor blade at some point when you're cutting the tape off, something like that?
Well, if you're going to cut it off, yes, but you should be using the edge of the tape. Your boundary should be the tape edge, not a cut edge, except at the ends.
Yeah. I've just had problems with even though you've put the tape on, you know, the paint that's gone over the edge of the top of the tape, you know, in places it'll seep under. But you're saying that maybe
the good ones, I've not had that problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll try that. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for your call. Our numbers again: 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go on to line 3. Good afternoon. Good morning.
I don't have a question or a problem this morning,
okay,
but I'm calling to say part of the bounty of living in Champaign-Urbana is listening to WILL and especially listening to Hank Spies.
Well, thank you, and Hank, thanks
thank
you.
I think his public service is over the top. He knows so much. He definitely is an intelligent man. He can communicate. And how lucky we are to have someone like this who could be doing a job and billing someone, giving public service. And so I say hats off to WILL and Hank Spies.
Well, thank you very much.
You've got some good-looking houses, too, to back you up there.
I guess I can.
All right. Let's go on to line 4. Good afternoon or good morning, line 4. Hello, line 4. You there?
Yes.
There we go.
For the woman with trouble painting in the corners, I've been painting for a number of years, and without using tape at all, I simply use a little pad that's about 3 or 4 inches square with tiny wheels on it that you run up and down the wall, and it gives you a straight edge without in the corner without use of tape.
Well, you're luckier with it than I have been.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about treatments for new concrete. I've got the one called ChemStop, and it's the silene and hydroxine solution that you've recommended before.
Mm-hmm.
Says, though, don't apply it for 4 weeks after the concrete is placed.
Yeah. Now, that's essentially a water-repellent treatment. The silane and siloxanes are water-repellent treatments.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting, the highway department uses a solution on fresh concrete, which they claim helps dry, and all it is one part of linseed oil, 5 parts of kerosene.
Okay, I've heard that. Even tried it. The neighbors detest it.
Well, that I don't doubt.
Yeah.
I don't doubt.
Not the best smelling thing in the world, I bet.
But I take it that solution with a linseed oil, 1 part in 5, I think you said.
Yeah.
Can go on either immediately on either new or old concrete.
Right.
Okay.
Right. That can do. The main thing that they're talking about not putting it on fresh concrete is that there's a lot of moisture to be evaporated out of fresh concrete, and we don't want to lock this in.
Oil and linseed do that too.
Well, it isn't nearly as proof as some of these other things. You get a lot more evaporation through the linseed oil and kerosene version than you do the
other. So that can go on immediately.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
And thanks for your call. 1-800-222-9455 outside the Champaign-Urbana calling area. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Let's go on now to line one in El Paso. Good morning. Good morning, line one.
My call.
Hello.
Hi. I visited with you quite some time ago about a metal roof for our home, and we have finally decided upon a system, a metal roof that we're going to have installed. But before we do that, we're going to attempt to make our dormers maintenance-free. So I have two big questions regarding the dormers. First of all, the difference between the highest quality aluminum siding and vinyl siding. The contractor will put on either one. I want to know what to ask for, what will be the best, and they're going to be white. So what do we do about siding in our attempt to make these dormers maintenance-free with the new roof on there?
Well, vinyl expands and contracts about twice as much as aluminum. So remember, it has to be nailed snugly, but not so snugly that it can't move. That's why it has slotted holes.
Mm-hmm.
We do not set the nails hard. We want to allow this siding to move. Secondly, vinyl siding is not waterproof. This means there has to be a weather barrier behind it.
Okay.
Whether this is house wrap or roofing felt or something of this sort, because the wind will blow water through vinyl siding.
Mm-hmm.
Then the real problem comes with flashing between the roof shingles and the siding. And that has to be done very carefully. There should be a piece of flashing for every row of shingles that turns up behind the siding.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, that flashing should go behind the house wrap or whatever your weather barrier is.
Okay.
So that anything that blows through and runs down the weather barrier can't run under the flashing.
Mm-hmm. If it's any help, too, we're putting the roofing over one layer of existing asphalt shingles.
Okay.
We've talked about that, and that seems to be acceptable.
That is acceptable, but you do need to have the new flashing with the new layer of roofing, too.
Okay.
Don't depend on the old flashing.
Right. Then getting back to the siding, what about the aluminum side of the story?
Well, the thicker the better. And generally speaking, it goes as though 0.028 or something like that is one of the standard thicknesses.
Now, in this, with the dormers being what they are, the longest piece of siding probably won't be more than 3 foot. You know, there'll be two sides in the front
right.
of the dormer, so it's going to be a lot of piecework.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I want the best, whether it's vinyl or aluminum, I just want the best.
Well, just remember that aluminum siding dents from hail.
Yeah, but it wouldn't crack. Would it?
No, it wouldn't crack.
Yeah.
And either of them will eventually chalk. In other words, the finish on them will eventually chalk 20 years or so down the line.
Okay. So, if you were doing it on your home, Hank, which would you put on?
Well, I'm not sure I would use either of those products.
Okay. The dormers presently are wood. You know, the house was built
right.
in 1950. And it's been painted regularly and well taken care of. But I'm not getting any younger either, and I don't need to be climbing around up there. And so while we're doing it, we'd like to put something on that would last for a long, long time.
Well, as I say, you should get about 20 years out of either one of them before they start showing any problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 20 years would be a fair shake.
Yeah.
Only go up there once every 20 years. I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah. Okay, so either one might be acceptable going with high-quality stuff.
Right.
And the other question, I need to know what to ask for. The contractor suggested putting in new windows in the dormers, and he said he would put in a high-quality window, as our home presently has the older wood windows with the replaceable storm windows, and we get along fine with it. But for these two dormer windows now, what do we go with, like a wood with a vinyl ramp or aluminum ramp? And I have seen some vinyl ramp windows that have deteriorated over time. So what should I ask him for?
I would go with one of the major brands, Anderson or Pella or something like this. Pella's are aluminum wrapped. Anderson's are vinyl wrapped. Both of them seem to do quite well in this area.
He mentioned another name, and it wasn't either, because those are the two that come to mind.
Marvin, perhaps?
Pardon?
Was it Marvin, perhaps?
No, I don't believe it was either. Tempo? Is there a...
Yeah, okay, Temco.
Temco.
Yeah.
I think that's what he mentioned.
Okay, I would consider that to be a lower quality window
okay.
than the others.
But Anderson, Pella, and Marvin would...
Yeah.
And there again, we're getting back to the material of the window and construction method. What do you recommend there?
Well, okay, it all depends on what you want. And all of these are available with wood interiors. They're available with plastic interiors. The major problem with windows is being sure that they are flashed correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a new ASTM standard method for flashing windows and doors, and that's what we recommend. Most building codes don't require it as yet. It hasn't been around long enough to have gotten through the building code process. But basically, there should be a 9-inch wide flashing around the windows. Across the bottom, then you bring the side flashings down over the bottom one, and then the top flashing goes over the side flashings so that everything sheds water.
Mm-hmm.
And this, if your builder is interested, it is an ASTM standard E2112.
Okay.
And they have very specific instructions as to how to do the flashing.
He said there would be minimal work on the inside of our home, simply taking off a couple of trim pieces, I guess. Our home has very nice birch trim, which
mm-hmm.
splits easily if you try to work with it. But he said there'd be minimal work on the inside of the home. I guess most everything
yeah.
is done from the outside.
Right.
Okay. So that part will be fine. And there again, like I say, so your choices of like wood wrapped in vinyl, and what are the other choices?
Wood wrapped in aluminum.
Wood wrapped in aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there again, I suppose each method has its advantages.
Each one has its advantages and disadvantages.
Okay.
The major disadvantage of the vinyl, we don't have a problem here, and that is that it's in high altitudes we have problems with the vinyl wrap because the ultraviolet is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
It causes the vinyl to deteriorate.
Right. Vinyls are getting better all the time, aren't they, for UV protection?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. I know how the sun, when it just beats on something every day, what it does to plastics and stuff, it just cooks it.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for your calls.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. If you have a question for Hank Spies, our monthly guest from Spies Home Inspection Service, to answer your questions about home improvement. Let's go on now to line number two. Good morning, line two. Hello, line two. I think we have him here. Line two? Okay, we'll go on to line three. Line three, good morning. Hello, line three. They're dropping right and left. Line three, are you there with us this morning? Okay, we'll try. We'll go on to line four. Are you there, line four? There we go. We've got some. Well, we had somebody there, but we've just lost the call. 333-9455. Do bear with us this morning. We've got a few phone problems this morning. Things just happen to give way on a Monday morning, I suppose. But bear with us, and we'll be able to take your calls very shortly. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And if you did get cut off, be sure to give us a call back. We've got the phone lines, I think, resolved right now. Line 1 has a question right now. Good morning. Hello, line 1. Well, yeah, we normally push the buttons here in the studio, but apparently that's not working today. So we'll go and cross our fingers and see if we can get a couple of these other lines answered. And we will move on to if we can get a cue from which line we should take next, line one, where they hung up. And we'll try, I assume the next one would be line two, if I'm correct. And as they get set in line two, okay, we'll try something. In the meantime, we've had these problems before with the phones, but hopefully we can get them resolved. This is a call-in show. Let's try line four. Line four, are you there with us now? Hello, line four. Nope, I'm not hearing anything. Okay. You mentioned vinyl siding, and you mentioned rain getting into vinyl siding. Are we talking about all types of siding where that's a problem, or is that a specific problem with vinyl?
It's much more of a problem with vinyl because the joints are far more subject. And actually, vinyl siding is made with weep holes so that any water that gets behind it can get out, but that means water can be blown in as well.
So there's no way to make those weep holes somewhere else where it's...
Right. You have to have a weather barrier behind the vinyl, or you will eventually have problems.
And what kind of barrier are we talking about? You mentioned home wrap.
The house wraps, and again, these things have to be applied so they lap from bottom up so that every succeeding layer drains over the other one. Roofing felt will work. We sometimes tape the joints in foil-faced insulation board, and that's a satisfactory method of doing it. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is we've got to have that house wrap there, and then we've got to have that flashing around the windows and doors.
What kind of insulation, if any, does the house wrap provide, or is that just
None.
A simple plastic barrier?
It's a simple water barrier.
Do they make stuff that has sort of both qualities? Or?
Well, to an extent. Some of the foils, but a foil... Reflective insulation only works if it's facing an airspace. And generally speaking, we don't have much of an airspace when you put siding over it. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't help. So the foam boards, the plastic foam boards with a aluminum face will provide you with some. Many times in installing siding over old siding, they use about a quarter inch thick, what we call fanfold board. The insulation value provided by that is negligible.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask this is just getting back to my own house experience. I have a house that was built in an era where they didn't really care too much about insulation, apparently. It wasn't that big a deal. And now I'm sure there are a lot of homeowners out there who face the same problem of trying to put in insulation in a house that may not have been meant for it.
It was fairly difficult to justify the expense of a lot of insulation when gas was 10 cents a therm. Now that it's 60 cents a therm, it becomes much more important. But our real problem was we're spending a lot more effort on making the house airtight than we did before. And that was the problem with these old houses when the curtains blew and the window was closed.
Yeah. Which has its pluses and minuses. But
yeah, it's got an awful lot more minuses than pluses. Mm.
Why is that? I mean, we'll take a look at it this way. It's, you know, this is weather like we have today, fairly decent weather, you think. It would be nice to just open up the windows and let the air blow through the house.
I don't believe I have opened a window in at least 5 years.
No kidding.
This is the Midwest. Mm-hmm. We have hot air. We have humid air. We have cold air, and depending on what direction the wind is coming from, we have stinking air. I would just as soon keep it out there. The air in my house, generally speaking, is a heck of a lot healthier than what comes in the window.
Is there a concern, though? I mean, some people think, well, that's not fresh air coming into my house.
There isn't any such thing.
Uh-huh.
There really is nothing, this so-called fresh air. You get every piece of pollen that everybody is allergic to comes in every time you open the window. If you could see moisture vapor, you would see it just pouring into the window.
Right.
This is particularly true with those people who run air conditioning during the day and open their windows at night, because your air conditioner works all day the next day, pumping the water out that came in with that air. Mm-hmm. And so controlling the humidity is an important part. And as I say, if you open the windows, you can't control the humidity.
Correct. As far as the air intake, in most systems, do you get some air pulled in from outside where it goes
to the furnace system? You will get some. You should get maybe a quarter of an air change per hour. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly acceptable. If we get a house that's tightly sealed, we may actually put in a mechanical intake system. But we will carefully filter it before it comes in. It isn't a matter of opening the window. We get a good fat filter in there so that a lot of this stuff that we don't want doesn't make it in. And as I say, the real problem in this area is controlling humidity, and you cannot control humidity with an open window.
What kinds of filters are available? And those have changed over time as far as...
Those have changed substantially over time. The best, of course, is the electronic filter, which will take out particles down to the size of smoke. Second best is the high-efficiency mechanical filter, which is about 4 inches thick, folded paper filter, much like the air cleaner on your car
right. Is.
And those will take out particles down. It will normally take out tree pollens, but not necessarily grass pollens. There is a discussion of all the varieties of filters that are available and how they perform on my website. If you call up my website at www.hankspees.com and go into the various sections of it, there is a section there on filters. And, you know, even the kind that the little 1-inch thick filter that you slip into your furnace.
Right.
There's at least 6 varieties of those things, and they cost anything from 59 cents to $10.
How about, you know, picking one of those? I mean, obviously, is it true that you pretty much get what you pay for? You know, the better the furnace, the more costly the filter, the better that you're getting.
The 59-cent one will catch dust bunnies, and not much of anything smaller than that. Whereas we have some very good ones, but you'll be in the $7 to $10 range for them, and they're only good for at the most 3 months. The other thing that most people don't change their filters often enough, so it tends to restrict the flow through the heating and cooling system, and we don't get the air distribution in the house that we're looking for.
Plus, you're probably spending a little more trying to get all that air through the house, too.
You see, one of the ways to check your air conditioning is to put a thermometer at the return air duct. Leave it there for about 5 minutes while the air conditioner is running, and then move it to a supply duct and see how much the temperature drops. If your air conditioner is 5 years old or less, the temperature drop between the two should be between 10 and 15 degrees. If it's an older air conditioner, it will probably be between 15 and 20 degrees. If the drop is more than that, this means we have inadequate airflow through the system. Mm-hmm. Now, this can be due to a number of things. It can be due to a dirty filter. It can be due to having too many outlets closed in the system. And just too many ducts outlets are closed off, so we're not getting enough. Now, if you are getting less than 10 degrees, call the repairman. There's something wrong. And as I say, you want to check. Most air conditioners have variable speed motors on the fans. And they change speed between heating and cooling. We have to move about twice as much air to cool as we do to heat.
Right.
And if something isn't working right on the fan speed, you will get overcooling. You know, you'll get this 20, 25-degree temperature drop, and your system just isn't as efficient.
And it's all due to that one air filter that you're supposed to replace on a regular basis.
At least that's one of the major factors is the air filter.
We're talking with Hank Spies. We normally answer your home maintenance questions once a month here on Focus 580. We do have some problems with our phone lines, and we're trying to get them solved as we speak, and hopefully we'll have some room for some questions in a couple of minutes. But please bear with us, and we'll hopefully be able to take some of those questions. I remember when I first moved into my first house, speaking of furnace filters, I didn't have the ones that you replace that you buy, the paper ones that you buy at the store. We had the ones that you took out and washed. Mm-hmm. Are those still in use? Are there good things and bad things about those?
Generally speaking, their efficiency on fine particles is not great unless after you wash them, re-spray them with a sticky coating that things will hang on to. But, yeah, they're still in use, and there's nothing really wrong with them. They say they're not good for fine particles.
Yeah. Okay, let's look. We've got a couple of in lieu of being able to put phone lines on the air this morning, we do have somebody who's helping take some questions off the air, and you are able to give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Our producer Travis Stansel is busily working in the other studio, transposing some of those questions and sending them into here, so we can answer your questions this morning, but you won't be able to get on the air, unfortunately. But one caller called up and has some walls that were sponge painted and wants to remove the texture, smoothen the texture out. What kind of sandpaper should he use, or is there another way to get the wall smooth? And also he's asking whether he should use a joint compound.
There are multiple ways of doing this. Yes, you can sand. You're going to need an open coat paper, otherwise the paint will plug the paper very rapidly. Mm-hmm. If there is a lot of texture there, it may be about as easy to put a skim coat of joint compound on it as anything else. I do wish these decorators who advocate these finishes would take into consideration what it's going to take to get them back off again.
Exactly.
There are some, depending on what kind of paint they've used, if you lightly spray the wall with water, let it soak for 20 minutes and scrape it, and a lot of it will come off.
Hopefully none of the drywall finish will come off.
That's right. You've got to be careful as to how much water you use, because we don't want to get into the paper on the drywall.
Mm-hmm. How about joint compound? Can you work that way?
You can skim coat it with joint compound, mm-hmm. and if you are good, you will get a smooth finish.
But you've got to be good. Pretty smooth-handed. We've got another caller who called up and says he has a 100-year-old house that has hardwood floors, and parts of the floor are lifting up. I don't know if it's the floorboards or the entire thing. Should he replace the individual boards, or is there a way to pull them down from below?
You can pull them down from below. I suspect he's got a moisture problem somewhere that is causing the wood to expand and then buckle. So I'd be looking for the source of the moisture first. But otherwise, yes, there are a number of products. Squeak Ender is one of them that screw into the bottom of the floor joist and then fasten that to the floorboard and fasten it to the floor joist. Mm-hmm. Some of that can be done. If the hardwood itself is in good condition, I would try and go with something like that rather than pick it up. Our real problem with old hardwood floors is that they've usually been sanded too often.
Yeah.
And a hardwood floor can only be sanded twice.
No kidding. You'd think that, you've got, three-quarter-inch thick boards or half-inch boards.
We have tongue and groove edges. Uh-huh. And when the top edge of the groove gets thin, it splits off.
Right. So twice and replace the whole floor.
You will probably end up replacing the whole floor.
Are there other reasons why that may be pulling up other than moisture?
That's the usual one.
Uh-huh.
It depends if the framing is moving or something like that, but usually it's moisture caused.
We're still taking your calls. Unfortunately, we're not being able to get you on the air, but you can leave your questions with our producer, Travis Stansel, who's answering the phones, and he's forwarding them in to us this morning, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Caller has a multi-flow septic system with a gravel-filled evaporation pit. He says, is there a problem running sump pump exhaust into that pit?
I would not want to run the sump pump there because it may be just producing too much water for it all to evaporate or soak in. I don't like to mix sump pump effluent with the sewage treatment effluent because we usually end up drowning the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Much more water comes out of the sump pump.
So I'm trying to remember where I guess some of the when I also had a house that had a sump pump and a septic system and it all went to the same place. It does make that much of a difference when you've got
water? You can not dump that much water into a septic tank field. It won't absorb enough to handle the extra flow from the sump pump. It's designed specifically to handle the house flow.
What types of things, say a person is moving into a house that has a septic system and, like me, I have no idea, almost no idea how a septic system works, much less how to repair things, how to maintain it, how to know that some of the things that they suggest to help maintain septic systems really do the job. What kinds of things you do for as a basic maintenance kind of thing?
Well, if you don't have a garbage disposer, you want to be sure that the tank gets pumped every 7 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. If you do have a disposer, it's 3 to 5 years.
Just get rid of
whatever's in the bottom, because a septic tank has basically three operating layers. One is non-digestible mineral material that sinks to the bottom. Then we have a water solution that is loaded with the anaerobic bacteria that actually break down the sewage. And then there is about 6 inches of scum on top. And the main thing that we have to do is be sure that the mineral material in the bottom does not get washed out into the disposal field, because this is very fine particles and it will plug the soil so that the soil no longer absorbs. Mm-hmm. The same way, we should never run the backwash from a water softener into a septic system in this area, because adding salt in the backwash from the water softener is very salty, makes clay very tight and it quits absorbing water.
The anaerobic bacteria, is that stuff that needs to be replaced now and then?
No,
you go to the supermarket and you see these things of Red X and they say, use it to make sure that your septic system keeps working.
Total waste of money.
No kidding.
Yes. Now, the one thing that you can, if you have a septic disposal field and there are trees out there and you think the thing is loading with tree roots, about every 4 to 6 months, you dump a pound of copper sulfate down a toilet, and that will discourage the tree roots.
Discourage them but not necessarily kill them, I would think.
It doesn't kill the tree, but it will kill the roots. It will open the field back up.
Right. We've got another caller asking if you have any information on an acrylic material to be painted on roof shingles to extend the life of a shingle and make roofs last longer. Sounds like another product that's out there that you've passed judgment on.
Another product that's out there, and the basic problem is you're usually covering up a bad substrate. Mm-hmm. And if you have a bad substrate, nothing is going to last well. I would not consider such a product.
What if you used a product once the roof is on? You'd have a fresh, brand-new roof.
Well, why would you?
To preserve a shingle, perhaps?
Okay.
Is it used as a preservative at all?
No, I wouldn't think that. Generally speaking, your ordinary asphalt shingle, the first layer will last 20 years on the average. Mm-hmm. If it lasts less than that, you've got some other problem, moisture from the bottom or whatever. The second layer of shingles will last on average of 15 to 17 years. We never recommend a third layer.
And tear it off after two layers.
After two layers, tear it off. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of these little granules on the surface of the shingles are not only decorative. Primarily, it is to protect the roofing felt underneath from the sun. So if we have anything that's wearing those granules off, if the sun can get to the felt, there'll be a hole within 2 years.
And those granules wearing off is just a natural aging process. If you see them, collecting in your gutters or something like that, that's not to be too concerned about unless your roof is rather old.
Or else you've got a tree limb that's rubbing against it and rubbing them off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a quick way to a hole.
So it's not necessarily a sign that you need to run out and get a new roof. You've got a few years of that going on and afterwards. We have a caller who is asking if you can give your number out over the air. The caller wants to know about a gutter guard type thing that Hank didn't want to mention on the air. I don't know what he's talking about. This sounds like an inside question to me. But.
All right. You can give a call and leave a message at 356-5048, and I will send you something.
I always kind of hesitate to do that because we know we get lots of calls on this program. I would not want to, you know, chain you behind a desk for 60 hours a week just answering people's questions. I know you like to do it, but
I'm not overly prompt. Right now I'm very busy, but I will get some stuff out for you if you leave your address.
And if you do have a question, we still have a few minutes that we can take your question off the air and relay it to Hank through me. The number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 outside the Champaign-Urbana area. And we do apologize for the lack of phones this morning. Speaking of gutter guards, we're starting to see commercials for them all over the place. Are these things that are worth your time? What kinds of recommendations do you have about them?
What you're willing to pay for them.
Uh-huh.
If you have a two-story house and you feel unsafe on ladders, then I guess it's a good idea. One of my friends tried this, and he's slightly older than I am, and he ended up in the hospital because he went off the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it would have been cheaper to put on gutter guards.
Right.
There is some debate as to how effective they are, particularly ones that you cannot clean under, that you may get fine stuff that still ends up in them. There's several of them work on different theories, and most of them work pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a drastic difference. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, you can get them for 75 cents a foot. If you hire them done commercially, they can be as high as $15 a foot.
Right, right.
And I think the latter is ridiculously overpriced.
Another question that's come in. Caller has a 6x6x8 half bathroom, and he wants to know what the smallest exhaust fan he can use and if he has recommended for a quiet one. Measured in, I can't read the last one, but exhaust fans for bathrooms, especially small ones.
Yeah. Generally speaking, you're going to need something in the 60 to 80 CFM range, and your sound rating is in sones.
Sones, okay.
And the lower the sones number, the quieter the fan,
mm-hmm.
and usually the higher the price.
Right. As far as ventilation goes, half bath, we don't have to worry too much about moisture or anything like that. But
right.
Exhausting into an attic is probably okay, or just filtering
back
out of the bathroom.
I'm not fond of exhausting humid air from the house into the attic, but basically it's purely a matter of odor control.
Mm-hmm. One question to follow up on the roof questions that we were talking about. Is there an advantage of 30-year shingles over 20-year shingles besides 10 years, I guess?
Well,
or is that true?
You probably won't get 10 years.
No kidding.
You have to realize that shingle warranties are prorated,
mm-hmm.
and they only cover the cost of the shingles, not the labor involved. Therefore, the manufacturer can put a long warranty on, and he'll say, well, you know, you got three-fourths of the life of it. We pay one-fourth of the cost of new shingles. But only the shingles, not the labor to do it. And the new 30 and 35 and 40-year shingles that I have been seeing on the roofs, I don't think are going to make it that long.
Okay. A couple of other questions before we wrap it up. Are the desktop air cleaners that we're seeing bogus or worthwhile? $300 or $400 to buy one of these desktop air cleaners. What do you think?
I wouldn't spend it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's the best way of handling it. I'd rather spend the $300 or $400 on an electronic air filter in my heating system, which will clean the air in the whole house.
And we just talked about that through the
electronic
the furnace
air
system.
Right.
Okay. Someone, a caller, said that someone had painted tar on a concrete wall. How do you get the tar off? The wall is an exterior wall. Is there a way to get as much tar as possible off that wall?
You're probably going to end up sandblasting it.
No kidding.
That doesn't sound like fun, and it's going to change it. The concrete is not going to look like it ever did before.
Does it hurt the integrity of the concrete?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
But tar on concrete is almost impossible to remove.
Your opinion on geothermal heating and air conditioning compared with your typical high-efficiency gas furnace? They're still selling heat pumps these days, and
yes,
they were touted as
geothermal is very efficient. The only problem is it's expensive to put in. A geothermal system may cost 2 to 3 times as much as a conventional heating system. However, its operating cost may well be a quarter to a third of the conventional system. I know people with geothermal systems whose power bills are in the $30 to $40 a month range all winter.
Right.
So I'm all in favor of geothermal. I think this is going to be one of the energy-conserving ways. I think we're going to go to more and more geothermal in the long run. But our real problem is installation cost.
Installation costs, especially with somebody who, I mean, if you're planning on living in your house for 20, 30 years, you know, the math adds up.
Yeah. But geothermal, you have a couple of possibilities. One is to drill wells, drop a loop of pipe down it. Now, no casing, let the dirt cave in around the pipe. We can also bury them in trenches 6 to 8 feet long, or if you're fortunate enough to be around a pond that's at least 10 feet deep, you can run a loop out into the pond. And these are really quite efficient.
How much is a geothermal system compared to a regular high, say, with a high efficiency, which in exchange is higher than your standard furnace anymore?
Generally speaking, for an average size house, a geothermal system would probably be about $7,500. Heating, that covers, of course, both heating and cooling. Mm-hmm. A conventional heating and cooling system would probably be in the $2,500 to $3,500 range.
So with geothermal, you still have your air conditioning unit, you still have your furnace. It's just that you also have the heat pump.
Well, no, it does both the heating and cooling.
Oh, so the one unit
device
inside your house.
Does both.
All right. You know what? I think we just made it through an hour without phone calls. How we did that, I don't know, Hank. But as usual, thanks for your input. Listeners, thank you for your expertise on home improvement and maintenance. And we look forward to seeing you next month, and we'll have some phone calls ready for you next
month. All right, fine.
Thanks a lot. Hank Spies is with Spies Home Inspection Service. Coming up in the next hour, I will be replaced on this microphone by Kevin Kelly, who's a WILL-FM announcer. And the guest host, he'll be talking to author and musicologist Kevin Bazzana, the author of a book called Wondrous Strange, The Life and Art of Glenn Gould. That's coming up after NPR News. And we will break now for a look at the markets and before we go into NPR News, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members at agrivisor.com.
And with this update on the markets, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. The wheat contract for July at 356 is up 3.25 right now. September wheat at 365.5, up 4. The corn contract for July at 272.5, down 2. The September at 277, down 1.25. December corn at 279.75, down.